Well, those are very interesting questions. The third one, I think, is a little bit different from the other two, so let me address all of them in slightly different ways. So one of the things that always puzzles me is why people pose the controversy, the principles in conflict question around science and technology in the particular ways that you have posed them. So that we have principles in conflict is a fact of life. You know, you want to get your child the best education possible. You have limited money. Your child is brilliant, but you live in, if you're in America, in the state of Michigan, which has a good public university system, you can't afford to send them to Harvard. There are goods in competition. You might like them to have the cachet of Harvard. You can't afford it. You know, so you make a choice. I mean, you know, there are principles in conflict. You know, do you put yourself in enormous debt to send your child to Harvard? Or do you say Michigan can give that person an equally good education and then they can, you know, earn their own way somewhere else later on down the line? We're continually confronting problems of this sort. So why is it that in the context of DDT or GMOs, it suddenly becomes a crying conflict as if, you know, we have no ways of getting around them? The other thing that puzzles me somewhat in these stories is that somehow the capacity of exactly your sector of society to innovate gets very selectively invoked. So why should DDT, just because its discoverer got a Nobel Prize, well-deserved and so forth, why should it be taken as a stable element in the world? I mean, there are lots of things we did. Supposedly the Romans, to take a case nearby, became sterile in part because the elite consumed warmed up wine in lead containing vessels, and therefore, you know, this is a story about the decline of the Roman Empire, right? Well, whatever the truth or falsity of that story is, the fact is we no longer heat up wine in containers lined with lead, because we've learned that that's not something you do with lead. In the state of Massachusetts, where I live, you're not allowed to rent an old house to a family with children under, say, the age of 5, because there may be lead paint still in the paints with which the house built in the Victorian era was painted, and that lead could have an effect on young children who are eating paint chips that are peeling off. And therefore, what was once considered good technological practice is now avoided. If you do want to rent to young families, you have to have the entire lead stripped off and the entire house repainted, and so on and so forth. So these are examples of places where, upon discovering that something was the matter with the world as we created it 50 or 100 years ago, we have now figured out different ways of doing it. We no longer make paint based in lead or with lead as a base, or we change behavior to make sure that the harmful aspects of what we're trying to do not happen. Now, with DDT and malaria, it's not that anybody is denying the persistence of organic pollutants in the environment. That is taken for granted in scientific consensus. What seems to be equally taken for granted is that this is the best way for the malarial countries to get ahead and to get rid of the malaria. That's what I mean by suddenly somehow the innovative imaginary stops dead. Why? I mean, why should a world that's saying, you know, you should implant human neuronal cells into mouse brains and see what kind of consciousness results, suddenly say, oh, but when it comes to DDT and malaria, this is our solution? I mean, you know, why not innovate there too? Why not find something that is not going to accumulate as a POP, persistent organic pollutant, in the environment? And of course, we also know a great deal from the public health world. We know that the reason that we don't have malaria in technologically advanced countries is not because DDT eradicated it, but because we have clean water, we don't have dirty water standing around, we don't have malarial populations, and even in places with malarial mosquitoes hanging around, if you use elementary precautions, if you could afford them, like mosquito netting, and people understood to keep their children inside the mosquito nets and so on and so forth, you could prevent malaria without necessarily the resort to DDT. So I don't think, I mean, you know, I don't think these are insoluble problems. We've figured out how to handle many of those, for instance, through a staged phase out in places that can't afford it while you're staging in something else. We've done this repeatedly in environmental law and regulation, that countries that cannot comply or regions that cannot comply instantaneously are given a little more time for other innovative capacities to come into play. And eventually you get the standard. We've lived with malaria as long as human beings have been around, probably, that we can't eradicate it overnight. I mean, you know, this is sort of taken for granted. One of the interesting social innovations is to recognize that malaria is a global disease, and there actually could be something like an emerging global human right not to have malaria, and therefore that developed countries are prepared to spend money to eradicate it in developing countries. I think that's a genuine imaginative leap, to recognize that wherever in the world you're situated, if you're a baby or a child, you have a right, almost an incipient global human right, to grow up malaria-free. If we take that seriously and channel our energies to making that imaginary come about, not the imaginary of the mosquito that must be eradicated, but the imaginary of the child that must grow up healthy, I suspect you might let loose other sorts of creative potentials in the world. With GMOs and food prices, I have seen, I'm not an economist, on the other hand, I do read economic arguments with a certain degree of skepticism conditioned by my very Humean field of training, science studies. And I've seen nothing that indicates that there is a tight, unbreakable connection between more GMOs and lower food prices. American food prices were extremely low to start with for many dozens of years. People recognize that this is because of an investment in a particular kind of agricultural production policy in America. Those of us who care about food, and in Italy that would be almost everybody, in America it's a small fraction, know that there's been a price to pay for the cheaper food, like no taste. I mean, we have lots of beautiful tomatoes. They look wonderful. They sit in heaps in supermarkets. You never, never, never can get a tomato that has any taste left in it. I mean, you know, these are trade-offs. And a lot has been written by economic historians on the production of the square, perfect, never rotting, easily transportable supermarket tomato that also has no taste. So these are choices that we've made. And it's not clear to me that GMOs in the American context are doing anything other than stabilizing a kind of price structure and product structure that we have developed and kept alive by other forms of industrial agriculture for a very long time. So I have to see that there is a really, you know, sort of demonstrable connection between the current rise in food prices and GMOs as a solution to those food prices. By the way, I am by no means against the idea of genetic modification as an innovative strategy. It seems to me that what has not been thought through is how the technique should sit along with a whole complex of other agricultural industrial strategies. And I happen not to believe that something that has, quote, worked in America, unquote, necessarily is right for the rest of the world, because it has worked in America against a backdrop of many other kinds of social, political, economic arrangements. America is a nation of immigrants who are very mobile. We place a high value on being able to pick up stakes here, go there, and find the same world in effect. I mean, people want a kind of evenness. McDonald's stations everywhere on that highway that is constructing the American imaginary, because the road is such an important element in it. The standardized food, you go from Boston to San Francisco, and everywhere you find the same things. except when you become the Bobo generation and, you know, therefore are now suddenly valuing other things. It's a kind of standardization that Americans have valued for a very long time. It's not a standardization that everybody thinks is beneficial. So, you know, to take an agricultural technology that fits a particular model of the market, a particular model of pricing structure, a particular sensibility about how much of your take-home budget you should be spending on food, and to say, generalize it, standardize it, make it worldwide, you know, okay, maybe everybody wants that, but then they should vote on it. They should understand what the issues are. And, you know, the Japanese, for sure, do not want to give up their food habits and Kobe beef for the sake of having the American diet and spend 10% of their food budget instead of 20, I mean, of their budget on food, instead of the 20 to 25% that they spend the rest of the time. I mean, these are trade-offs that people should be actively engaged in thinking about. As far as the in vitro fertilization thing is concerned, there you're raising a question that I think is tremendously important for democracy as a whole. There are infinite numbers of technical issues, and embryonic stem cells versus adult stem cells is only, you know, what doctors might call a presenting symptom of a much wider set of complexities. And how do people democratically engage with those is a very important question. But how do we about anything? I mean, you send your child to school and you expect that they will be taught stuff. How do you know that they're being taught anything? How do you know that the standards that are used for textbooks are relevant standards? How do you know that they won't get punched in the playground and develop a concussion? I mean, how do we know anything? You know, so how we know anything is through, I mean, you spoke about networks before, but what I'm slightly bothered by is this idea that networking is suddenly new with the information age. I think networking has been there all the time, and that networking is effective if it has a thickness, if it's not instantaneous, like, you know, I see you on Facebook and now you are part of my community. I mean, you know, people are talking about Web 2 types of communities that are very thinly attached. And people are talking about the fact that some of these information networks put you in the position where you're so busy presenting yourself that you're just crafting your individual identity to project it outward and are not really any longer interested in the feedback, the correctives, the friction with which societies, I think, become more robust. So we know something about why we trust people. It's partly because we've actually been engaged in frictions with them. We've fought them politically. We've seen them win and our side lose, and we've come back the next day and seen our side win and them lose. I mean, so, you know, it's through those kinds of interactions. One of my problems with this idea that people don't understand, therefore we should take scientific debate away from them, is that I think one of the most dangerous ways of creating a society is to produce friction-free pockets where everybody agrees, and you get groupthink, and you get people operating with tunnel vision. I mean, we know an enormous amount of organizational sociology that tells you that this is what happens. So why should we say that the ignorant should be kept out? I mean, maybe the ignorant should come back to remind us where we're not being very smart, where we're not thinking, you know, way ahead of time. I mean, you know, one of the lessons of the Vietnam War in the American context that many people took away was that better the first 1,000 names out of the Boston phone book than the top 100 Harvard professors to run the country.